Mourners in the occupied West Bank calling for justice following the assassination of a senior resistance fighter by Israel. The race to succeed British Prime Minister Liz Truss heating up. Senior Conservatives warning against the return of Boris Johnson to power. In China, Xi Jinping secures a historic third term as the country's leader for another 5 years. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Palestinians have held a funeral for a resistance fighter who was assassinated by the Israeli regime earlier this morning. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes and called for justice. The victim, identified as Tamer Al-Kilani, was killed in a bomb explosion in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. He was a member of Arin al-Osud resistance group that's now warning of a harsh response. Hamas has also said that the crime will not go unanswered. The Islamic Jihad has reacted by saying that the assassination will be retaliated. On Saturday, Israeli soldiers shot and wounded a 16-year-old Palestinian in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Al-Quds, claiming that he had injured an Israeli man in a stabbing attack. Iran has condemned contradictory comments by U.S. officials regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Abdollahian says that American authorities continue to exchange messages with Tehran, while at the same time fan the flames of anti-government riots in Iran. The top diplomat argued that the U.S. officials are seeking to exert political pressure in order to win concessions during negotiations. The comments were in apparent response to statements by U.S. authorities who have announced that the JCPOA revival negotiations are no longer on Washington's agenda. Amir Abdollahian rejects that and says it's a priority for the Americans to reach an agreement, and they want that as soon as possible. The foreign minister stressed that Iran will move within the framework of an agreement in which its red lines are respected. He added, however, that Iran won't leave the negotiating table. We have asked peace activist Daniel Kovalik about the United States' ultimate plan of pursuing a double standard policy vis-a-vis Iran, and here's what he had to say.
Well, look, I would like to see the deal entered into again by the U.S., but I'll be honest, I don't predict that it will be. For the reason you say, the U.S. does not want deals with Iran. It wants regime change. And honestly, I think it's just going to continue to play games with Iran over the nuclear deal and other issues and do everything it can to overthrow the government. So where is the incentive for Iran to negotiate here under those circumstances? I don't see it.
Now, former British Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now in the race for Conservative Party leadership and premiership, as senior members are pushing to prevent a comeback by former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Sunak coupled his announcement with a pledge to fix the economy, his supporters warning that Johnson's return would worsen the UK's economic turmoil. They're planning to secure an overwhelming support that would force Johnson to abandon the race. The former Premier has until Monday to announce his candidacy, but is still short of 45 MPs. Britain is reeling from rising inflation economic crisis. This has been worsened by an ill-advised tax plan by outgoing Prime Minister Truss. She was forced to announce her resignation on Friday after just 6 weeks in office. A new survey has found millions of households in Britain are skipping meals as they're struggling with the deepening cost of living crisis. The findings show inflation returns to 40-year high after food prices soar. Said Purza reports.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep. And very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Purizza, London.
In other news, Russia saying it's repelled an attack by the Ukrainian military to break through the border in the southern Kherson region, where it's evacuating civilians in anticipation of a counterattack.
In the Mykolaiv direction, the enemy attempt to breach the Russian troops' defenses by sending up to 2 battalion tactical groups on the west side of the Kherson region. All attacks were repulsed. The enemy was pushed back to their initial positions.
Konashenkov added Ukraine's offensive aimed at a number of settlements on the west side of Dnipro River. Russia has been under pressure in Kherson as it's bracing for a Ukrainian push to retake the region. Authorities have called on residents to immediately leave the city. The commander of Russian forces in Ukraine has described the military situation in those areas as tense and difficult. He says Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings in Kherson. Since late August, Ukraine has recaptured hundreds of kilometers in its counterattacks. In the meantime, Kyiv says that Russian strikes on energy facilities have caused massive blackout across Ukraine. The Ukrainian president says more than 1 million households are left without electricity. More than 670,000 of them are in the western region of Khmelnytsky alone, according to Ukraine's energy minister. Russian air raids have hit at least half of Ukraine's thermal generation capacity since October 10th. 40% of the country's energy infrastructure has been seriously damaged. The chief of Ukraine's national energy operator says that some parts of the country are reducing their electricity use by up to 20%, but energy authorities believe that the voluntary measures aren't enough for the regions where the infrastructure has suffered the most damage. In Donetsk, our correspondent John Amitter provides us with the latest about the front line as well as the propaganda and psychological warfare going on in Ukraine.
Yes, one Ukrainian official said the attacks yesterday by Russia were as bad as the strikes on the 10th and 11th of October. That's when, of course, Russia started hitting these energy, this energy infrastructure. It's interesting that we're not really seeing any pictures of the damage of these strikes. The reason for that is that the Ukrainian government has demanded that its citizens don't post videos of Russian strikes. Of course, many of the videos we see are just of ordinary people getting out their phones and filming the damage. But we're not seeing that now, as there's an attempt by the Ukrainian government to stop any panic that arises from these strikes. There's also a bit of a propaganda war, as they say that their air defense is working. It's not clear how well it is working. Russia says that it's hitting its targets every day. And as you were saying, there's around 40% of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has already been destroyed. In terms of the battle at the front lines, the major focus right now is on Kherson. Ukraine has been building up forces north of Kherson. Russia is evacuating tens of thousands of civilians. They're doing this for three reasons. One, to stop pro-Russian civilians falling into Ukrainian hands. Secondly, to save civilian lives from Ukrainian strikes against the city of Kherson. And thirdly, to help Russia itself have a better operational maneuverability on the battlefield, to enable them to use heavy weapons themselves and set up defensive positions without killing civilians as well. And finally, where I am, on the Donbass front, far to the north, east of Kherson, the front line's only about 5 kilometers from where I am now. Russia is trying to take advantage of Ukraine mobilizing in Kherson to make advances themselves in the Donbass. And they are making some slow, tentative advances near where I am now. Taking the rest of the Donbass and holding on to Kherson, very much the primary objectives of Russia right now.
Now, Italy's first female Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, and her cabinet have been sworn in by President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni is tasked with steering her country out of an economic storm that risks damaging long-term family livelihoods. From Italy, Max Civoli has the story.
On Saturday, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni took an oath as Italy's prime minister before President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni, the country's first woman to become premier, is one of the founders and the current leader of the far-right-leaning party Brothers of Italy, the political force that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in last month's general election. Besides bringing some political stability to Italy, which has seen 68 governments in its 74 years of history as a republic, Meloni will have to face a series of daunting challenges, including a looming recession, protecting Italians from surging energy bills, and reassuring the establishment about her Atlanticist and anti-Putin alignment.
Delegates from our coalition met with President Mattarella, and they agreed over the fact that there are many emergencies at national and international level, and quick answers are needed.
Italy's new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, says her government will follow the line of NATO and the Western Alliance. Also, the new foreign minister, former European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, has repeatedly said he will be fully supportive of Kiev. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier this week, a video portraying Berlusconi saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine caused a stir in the political arena. Italians are hoping the new government will work for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine.
We must do all we can to stop the war through negotiations and dialogue, and the new government must help Italians to pay energy bills. We are on our knees.
We are confident that the new government will do good. Its biggest challenge will be easing the impact of soaring energy bills on Italians.
Meloni is expected to lay out her political priorities next week when she faces confidence votes at the parliament that will confirm or not that she holds a majority. Max Civili, Rome.
Now, Xi Jinping will be the leader of China for another 5 years after the Communist Congress Party confirms his status. President Xi was picked as the party's general secretary for a third time in a closed-door vote. That means he'll be elected president at the annual meeting of National People's Congress in March. The new lineup of the party's seven-member standing committee over which Xi presides was also announced. Speaking to media at the event, President Xi said that China will open its doors to the world even wider in the new era. He noted that the country is on the path to modernization and will move towards securing better prosperity for its people. During its week-long gathering, the Congress approved the addition of new wording to the party charter, elevating Xi's core status. Independent China specialist Andrew Leung says that Xi Jinping is facing both domestic and global challenges during his third term in office.
Domestically, I think President Xi is known to have mentioned a number of traps for the nation. The first trap he mentioned was in the, 2018 Party Congress. He referred to the Tacitus trap, T-A-C-I-T-U-S, the name after the Roman emperor. Tacitus trap means if other countries do not believe in the Communist Party, for example, then whatever the Communist Party does would be seen negatively. The second trap, as everybody is familiar with, is the Thucydides trap, rivalry between the world's two great superpowers. And the third trap is the middle income trap, which entrapped a number of developing countries for a long, long time in middle income without rising to higher levels of development. The fourth trap is the what Professor Joseph Dye of Harvard Kennedy School refers to the as the Kindleberger trap. That is, even a country reaches the top of the world superpower, it's questionable whether that country can deliver in terms of global governance. As, for example, the ability of the United States at the moment to be able to maintain global stability is in doubt.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Today we will look at a few more verses on the topic of faith. There are a few points we must consider. Firstly, faith is one of the foremost qualities of God's prophets and the true believers who follow them. They have faith in their own message. This is the difference between divine leaders and the political leaders of the world today. A divine leader, as someone who follows this path, by whatever he says, by every step he takes, by the path that he follows, with all of his being, is a sincere believer. On the other hand, the world's political leaders might sometimes say nice things and give moving speeches, but this does not necessarily mean that they necessarily believe in what they say to even the slightest degree. There is a story about the leaders of one of the communist nations of the Eastern Bloc, who professed atheism and utterly rejected any culture or philosophy that was not based on materialism. This story takes place shortly after the Indian independence. In order to win the hearts of the massed millions of Indians who have just won their independence, these leaders visit India.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There, the people of India were amazed to see that the leaders of this communist nation had Tilaka marks on their foreheads. Tilak was one of the leaders of the Indian independence movement, as well as a Hindu religious scholar. He was one of the greatest leaders of the Hindu religion, and both a leader and a pioneer of the independence movement for a period of time. It is worth me taking some time to mention this to you, even though it is not directly relevant to our present discussion, because it is good to know about such things. From beginning to end, the Indian independence struggle lasted 90 years, and from the beginning to end, its most important leaders were all men of religion, whether Muslim or Hindu. Some of the most important Muslim leaders were Maulana Shah Mahmud Dehlawi, Maulana Mahmud al-Hasan, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad, Maulana Muhammad Ali, and Maulana Shaukat Ali. In any case, when these communist leaders, who espoused atheism and materialism, went to India, in order to win people over to their cause, they put the Tilak mark on their heads. In other words, they wanted to say, "Yes, us too, we believe the same as you." This, even though their own words and beliefs contradicted this statement. Those political leaders who are removed from spiritual, religious, or divine responsibilities are like this. But the prophets of Allah believed in whatever they spoke with the totality of their being.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed 136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
France is facing protests over the cost of living crisis fueled by soaring inflation. Police have clashed with the protesters, venting anger in the capital, Paris. Protesters were met with police brutality. Police used batons to disperse the protesters, who were throwing rocks at security forces. There are calls by trade unions for a nationwide transport strike. Unions now say it is time to expand the industrial action at oil refineries to other sectors. Protesters and strikers say they need pay rise to cope with the soaring cost of living. France is now experiencing inflation at 6.2%. That is the highest rate in decades. Striking workers are demanding higher wages from the profits of energy companies amid high oil and gas prices. Protesters have demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy. The industrial action has taken offline more than 60% of France's refining capacity. Macron's government is also on the defensive in Parliament, where it has lost its majority in legislative elections in June. It is much more difficult for his centrist alliance to implement his agenda against strengthened opponents. France is not the only country in Europe that is facing protests. European countries are facing more strikes and protests due to high energy prices and the mounting cost of living. The UK economy shrank by 0.3% in August. It experienced a 10.2% inflation rate in September, which was the highest in 40 years. The latest data shows that inflation rose on average to 10.9% across the European Union. Europe faces a very difficult economic climate if the current energy crisis worsens, with winter temperatures likely to be a decisive factor.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh US sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless. The US, Canada, and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, it's part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflict. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
Beijing's Great Hall of the People saw Xi Jinping, the Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party, attempt to cement his power by setting out to clinch an unprecedented third five-year term as president. In his address to some 2,300 officials and delegates from across the country, he laid out his policies and lauded some of his government's achievements. Among those achievements, President Xi reiterated the validity of his harsh zero-COVID policies. Policies which, to this day, shut down major cities and operations in China sporadically and disrupt businesses in a world increasingly accepting of COVID-19 as a reality to live with. In fact, China's civil aviation predicts that by the end of next year, the country's air traffic, while double the current figures, will still be just 15% of what it used to be before COVID. The policy's toll on people's mental health, though, may have been the biggest cost of China's success in containing the virus. Repeated lockdowns has resulted in the Chinese youth developing gaming addictions, sleep abnormalities, and a reluctance to go outside. Of course, COVID wasn't the only thing President Xi discussed in his address. He called for accelerating the country's military development while China already spends the second largest military budget in the world after the US. The military plan aims to improve China's ballistic missile capabilities, develop various aircraft carriers, and establish overseas outposts. Xi can lay out such military development plans because he doesn't just hold the title of President of People's Republic of China or the title of Secretary General of the CCP. He is also chairman of the Central Military Commission. Taiwan's relations with China, as well as the US, have been clearly defined in the One China policy. It is the diplomatic acknowledgement by the US that there is only one Chinese government and that the US can have no formal ties with the island of Taiwan, but rather with the Chinese government. The policy has a long history, dating as far back as 1949, after the end of the Chinese Civil War. But it was in 1979 when, under Jimmy Carter's presidency, the US finally established formal diplomatic ties with Beijing and thus severed ties with Taiwan and closed its embassy in Taipei. But in that very same year, the US also passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which meant that it would support the island's ability to defend itself by supplying it with arms. The US has always maintained strong informal ties with Taiwan. The One China policy was undermined much further during Trump's presidency, and not just because of former president's inflammatory remarks about China.
And then we had the horrible plague come in from China. Boy, oh boy, what they cost the world.
It was because after decades, Tsai Ing-wen, president of Taiwan, spoke to a U.S. president, breaking diplomatic protocol. Sino-US relations have only gone downhill from there. The biggest offense in the eyes of China happened when US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island in August in a move that infuriated China. Since then, Beijing's resolve to reunify with Taiwan has only gotten stronger. Xi Jinping has time and again rejected any form of separatism, as well as interference in the island's affairs, as it considers Taiwan a part of its territory. Xi's call for accelerated military development could hint at his impatience over US meddling and his increasing resolve over following through with his reunification plans with Taiwan.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, my dear sisters and brothers from all around the world, I hope you're all doing well. You are here with me for a better life. And, I'm Bita, and I am somehow interested in ethical issues in Islamic way. And I'm really honored and I appreciate the time I have to talk about somehow ethical and moral topics with you. I wish you all enjoy the episode of today. Today, I'm going to talk about, the most important aspects of morals and ethics. As you know, morals and ethics is a kind of, a vast area that we cannot just limit it with categories or something like that. But in general, as you know, there are four main categories in ethical issues, and I want to count them. One of them is wisdom, chastity, justice, and valor. The most practical form of ethics is actually valor, the hot topic of today that I'm going to talk about. And, I wish you just consider all of these and all the time you're going to spend listening to my audio, thinking about the way you are living, because you are listening to For a Better Life. And, I'm going to explain this issue more for you. First of all, I'm going to start with the meaning of valor. There are many misunderstandings and misconceptions about the meaning of valor, because most of the people get confused about the valor and cowardice. Maybe it's a big shock for you that I'm just, telling you that there is special similarities in cowardice and valor. But I'm going to leave you with this cliffhanger, and then we're going for a short break. Then we're going to come back and go on for our hot topic of today. Stay tuned.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to me for a better life. We're talking about one of the most important and most practical aspect of ethical issues, valor. First, I'm going to read your poem about bravery, about being brave and courageous in this world. You may write me down in history with your bitter twisted lies. You may tread me in the weary dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, I'll rise. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. This poem was a sign of bravery. If you ask me to explain it and define bravery in my own words, I just say, I act on my conviction.
and I face threats, challenges, difficulties, and pains despite my doubts and fears. But generally, a brave is one who puts himself in some danger, then saves himself or someone else from this danger. Actually, there are many discussions about being a brave person, good or bad, because sometimes you may put yourself in big, irrational dangers only to prove that you are a brave person. But what is it? Is it valor or bravery or stupidity? I want to tell you that the problem of this question is the misunderstanding of the meaning of bravery. So, to elaborate this area, I'm going to tell you that there is a delicate difference between being a brave person and being a cowardice. Sometimes you are in a situation that you cannot choose whether you have to fight for something or you have to stay in peace or you have to be silent because there are many other aspects that will be damaged because you are acting like you're fighting with that matter. You know what I'm telling you? The thing is, most of the people just cannot understand the paradoxical confusion between cowardice and valor. We're going to go for a short break, then we'll come back and then I'll elaborate this issue more for you. Stay tuned.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is For a Better Life. You're listening to me and we're talking about an interesting topic about valor and bravery. I was telling you that there is a paradoxical content between these two areas. I mean cowardice and valor or bravery. I want to tell you that bravery doesn't mean that you have to act aggressively, that you have to always be ready to put your sword on the neck of the other people, on the enemy. Actually, bravery means to stay calm and choose wisely what to do and what not to do in different situations. A coward person is someone who is just searching for a way to run away from the fears, from the obstacles, from difficulties, and many think more. But when you are a brave person, you will choose whether you're going to face this risk, you're going to face this difficulty, or you're going to find a way to go through this obstacle successfully. And this is the difference, dear listeners. So there is a meaningful bond between wisdom and valor. And, you know, as I told you, these are the two aspects of ethical values. Therefore, whenever the holy imams found the circumstances fit for use of sword, they resorted to force. And when conditions demanded patience and peace, they put their swords away and exhibited their valor. We cannot call this cowardice, as I told you, because coward is one who only, due to the weakness of his heart, bears the oppression of his enemy, and it is not the one who finds his strength ready for the confrontation. So, dear listeners, I'm going to tell you that actually valor and bravery is not something bad at all, but the balance that you have to find to walk on the edge of the sword is the key to this discussion. I want to end our discussion with a beautiful verse of Holy Quran. Surely Allah loves those who fight in His way in ranks as if they were a firm and compact wall. I wish you all enjoy the episode of today. This is all the time we had for our today episode. And I just want to tell you that you have to be brave. Just try to keep moderate in a wisely way. I leave you in a warm embrace of God. I wish you a blissful life. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share He knows.
Iran and the energy. The differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in their right.
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost." Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go up 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then U.S. President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. Next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to U.S. conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the U.S. honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Marie Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element.
Madame Curie.
The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. The award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1,600 years left everyone in astonishment.